Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Have you seen the new Hulu doc, Welcome to the Family? The murder of Dan Markell. It's about the Adelson family. Charlie Adelson, Donna Adelson, Wendy Adelson. Their friends, Catherine McBona, the whole crew comes in this four-part docuseries. And if you've not followed this case, you're probably like, whoa, I got to go learn more about that on the YouTube. Well, thank you. Welcome. You found the right place. We're about to put together a four-part series. Now, keep in mind, we've covered this case from way back. So if you want to actually watch the trial coverage and our commentary of it on the channel, there's thousands of videos for you to do that. But if you're wanting to kind of get the recap, we're going to give you a four-episode series here that really dives into what happened here in four different lanes over the next handful of days. We're going to be talking about the hit. That's today's video. We're going to talk about the dentist, Charlie, his dad. We're going to talk about the matriarch, Donna, and Wendy as well in our fourth video. The unindicted co-conspirator who has never had charges against her, maintains her innocence, got somewhat of a deal to say some things. Exactly what that deal is and how it protects her, we don't know the answers to those questions exactly, but whatever it is so far hasn't caused her to end up behind bars, and it may mean that's part of the agreement, or it may mean she just didn't know enough. We're going to dive into all of it, and I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we discuss the Adelsons. This is a wild, wild case. Dan Markell filed a motion in family court to keep his mother-in-law from being alone with his children. That's got to be a fun one to have to do. His boys were coming home saying, "Grandma says you're stupid. She says you're trying to take away her sunshines." That's lovely.
That's Donna.
That's who was telling the kids, her own grandchildren, "Daddy's trying to take the sunshines away from me. You're my sunshines." And then the kids go back to dad. "Why is Grandma saying this?" "Because Grandma's a narcissistic cunt." Oh, wait, you can't say that to children. You can't say that to kids. The hearing for that motion was scheduled, then continued, and never put back on the calendar because. Why? Well, Dan was dead before the judge ever heard it. Puts a little kink in plans. On July 18th, 2014, two men drove 5 hours from Miami in a rented Toyota Prius, followed Dan from his gym to his garage on Trescott Drive in Tallahassee, and shot him twice in the head. He was 41, a Harvard-educated law professor at Florida State, a father who'd dropped his two sons at preschool that morning. He built a career studying criminal punishment theory, authored a book called Privilege or Punish, founded a widely read legal blog called Prof's Blog, and held the chair at FSU's law school. He grew up in Toronto, came to Florida for the work, and stayed for the boys. He died at a hospital that night. that night because two men who killed him didn't know him were hired. And the family, the prosecutors say, ordered the hit, paid for it the way they ran every other piece of family business. Through the dental office. In monthly installments. With the grandmother signing the checks. What? Yeah. An interesting way to pay for a murder. Right there, basically, on company letterhead. With everyone involved. Can we get your signature on this, too, please? Okay, great. We just want to make sure the paper trail is really rock solid when we get convicted. Dan Markell married Wendy Adelson in 2006 and both worked at FSU's law school. The marriage fell apart after their two sons were born. Wendy filed for divorce in September of 2012. Court records say Dan came home from a trip and found the house was empty. Papers on the bed. The divorce was finalized in July of 2013. Then came the fight that made Dan Markell a target. Wendy wanted to move the children to South Florida near her parents and her brother Charlie. A judge denied the relocation permanently in June of 2013. The boys had to stay in Tallahassee near their father. They can't just move because grandma's needy. Because grandma is a needy, petulant 13-year-old in her brain. And thinks the world revolves around her because she's married someone who's made it that way and trained her children to do the same, except for the one who ran away to New York and is only the seemingly sane member of the family. No, you can't have your children moved, your grandchildren moved, be close to you because you want it when the father says, I'm sorry, I'm working over here. This is where I live and I'm the father. So my needs, my desires for my children supersede that of grandma. That should have been the end of it. In a family that respects court orders and respects the actual parents, it would have been. But Donna Adelson doesn't respect people, doesn't respect parents, doesn't respect really anything outside of Donna Adelson herself. According to the trial testimony, she offered Dan Markell $1 million to agree to the relocation. $1 million to let her daughter move the grandchildren south. So he would have less time with his own children. So grandma could have that. As if they're a hotel on Monopoly. Making a trade. I'll tell you what, I'll give you a park place for your grandkids, or for my grandkids, for your kids. Sound like a good deal? Okay. The court had already said no. He said no. And for a family accustomed to buying its way through every problem, hearing no twice was apparently one time too many. Dan Markell had won. He won by just wanting life to continue, as he had every right to have it continue. He was working. He had children. He got a divorce. He wasn't planning on moving anytime soon, and he didn't want his children moving far away. He has every right to say, nope, we're staying here. That's how that works when you produce children. You have rights. Especially when you're a good parent. The system told him he was right. The children stay in Tallahassee. The system told the Adelsons they lost. The question was what the Adelsons did with that answer. Wendy's mother, Donna Adelson, ran the books at the family's dental practice near Fort Lauderdale. She'd pushed harder than anyone for the move. Wendy's brother, Charlie, was a periodontist, earning between $3 million and $3.5 million a year, according to the prosecution's forensic accountant at a later trial. This was a family with resources and a problem they couldn't buy or litigate their way out of. It's a shock for the Adelsons. Charlie made a remark that would haunt him. A joke. A joke about buying Wendy a TV as a divorce present because it was cheaper than hiring a hitman. He told the joke to Wendy, to her boyfriend, to people he barely knew. A man so confident in his own untouchability that he was handing out the punchline to his own crime. A neighbor spotted the light-colored Prius leaving Trescott Drive after the shooting. Surveillance found Dan's gym showed the same car, followed him home that morning with a distinctive black side mirror and a SunPass toll transponder, a device that automatically plays tolls on Florida highways. Mainly South Florida highways. Tallahassee didn't have toll roads. The killers bought a car with a built-in receipt for every mile they drove. Investigators pulled toll records along I-75 that traced the Prius to a rental agency in North Miami. The car had been rented July 15th to the 21st. The agreement was in name of Luis Rivera, and a phone number on it led to his childhood friend, Sigfrido Garcia. Rivera was the leader of the North Miami Latin Kings, already in federal custody on racketeering charges. Garcia was the father of two children, and the mother of Garcia's children, a woman named Catherine McBanua, was also dating Charlie Adelson. Rivera later told investigators that he and Garcia had driven to Tallahassee once before in June of 2014, a month before the murder, but lost Markel and went home. They came back in July. Cell phone records placed both men's phone near Markel's home and near Premier Health and Fitness Center while he was inside, matching surveillance footage of the Prius in the parking lot. One woman connected the hitmen through their children and to the Adelson family through the bedroom. That's really the hinge of the entire case. After the murder, money made that connection impossible to ignore. 2 months after Dan was shot, McBanua started collecting paychecks from the Adelson dental practice. She never worked there, not a shift, not a day, not an hour. Donna personally signed 44 checks to her anyway. The total payments from Charlie to McBanua came to approximately $138,000 documented in financial records entered into evidence at four separate trials. Prosecutors traced payments starting 2 months after the murder and running for nearly 2 years. It was a steady flow of money from a dental practice to a woman whose only connection to that office was a man who ran it and the woman who kept the books. The cash portion arrived in brown paper bags, according to trial testimony, with $100 bills stapled in $1,000 increments. Donna had literally washed the money before handing it off. Laundered it. Donna thought laundering money meant putting it in the washing machine. Literally. Her own son admitted on the witness stand years later, like he was describing something his mother did with the towels. With a bit of embarrassment that, yeah, she is that stupid.
How did I know when laundering the money I wasn't supposed to use Tide with bleach?
Luis Rivera cooperated with prosecutors and pled guilty to second-degree murder for a 19-year sentence. He testified at every subsequent trial. His account? Garcia recruited him. Garcia pulled the trigger, and the motive was custody. Rivera recalled Garcia telling him, the lady wants her two kids back. She wants full custody. Rivera said he was paid $35,000 for his role. That's one cooperating witness's account, a gang member who cut a deal. The defense attacked Rivera at every trial. His story never changed across four proceedings and nearly a decade of cross-examination. But Rivera alone couldn't prove the Adelsons ordered the hit. He was a gang member with a deal. His testimony placed the hitman at the scene and the money in McBanua's hands, but it couldn't prove what Donna or Charlie knew or when they knew it. The financial trail showed money moving from a dental office to a woman connected to the killers. Suspicious, yes. Proof of a murder contract? No. Prosecutors needed the family to react to pressure, and they needed that reaction on tape. So the FBI built a trap. In April 2016, an undercover agent named Oscar Jimenez walked up to Donna Adelson outside her Miami condo. He handed her a newspaper article about Dan's murder with $5,000 written on it and a phone number. He dropped two names, Katie and Tuto, McBanua and Garcia. The message was designed to sound like someone from the killers, The killer's world knew what happened and wanted more payment. What mattered wasn't what Donna said to the agent. What mattered was who she called next. She didn't call the police on her husband. She called Charlie. 3 times in a row. If a stranger hands you a murder article and names the dollar amounts, and you've never heard any of it, you call 911. If you already know every name on that paper, you call your son. Charlie met McBona at the Dolce Vita restaurant near Miami Beach, where the FBI recorded 41 minutes of conversation. The tape sat for years, too garbled to use under a former CIA audio expert who enhanced it, and Charlie's voice came through a little more clearly. On the possibility of being investigated, quote, if they had any evidence, we would have already gone to the airport, unquote. Remy McBona's no-show dental job, yeah, quote, you work for the office now because the checks are from there, unquote. On the money, quote, when everybody was there the next day, did any of you take any money, end quote. His defense later argued the tape was exculpatory. Charlie also said, I've got nothing to hide, but the tape is only half the evidence. The bump produced. The other half is Donna's phone log. 3 calls to Charlie, 0 to police. That doesn't need a CIA expert to interpret. In April of 22, State Attorney Jack Campbell announced that the enhanced recording led to Charlie Adelson's indictment and arrest 8 years after Dan's murder. The case was built from the ground up, and every layer pointed back to the same dental office, the same family, and the same checks. Dan Markell's sons were in preschool when their father was shot. Wendy moved them to South Florida within days and later changed their last names to Markell, or from Markell to Adelson. Dan's parents, Ruth and Phil, were cut off from their grandchildren. The custody order that was supposed to keep the boys near their father died with him in that garage. But a toll transponder, 44 checks to a woman who never worked at a dental office, and 41 minutes of tape in a Miami Beach restaurant would eventually bring the whole family down. That's coming up next. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. I'm going to be dropping you a whole series of Adelsons in the coming days. If you want the full deep dive into it beyond what you saw in the doc on Hulu, hit subscribe. We got it for you. And give us your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or our Substack. Those links are in the description. And if you want to take the audio with you, if you don't want to, you know, you're watching YouTube right now, probably, be sure to take the podcast with you. The link is in the descriptions. Hidden Killers, just search it wherever you get podcasts. There's a QR code on the screen right now if you're watching us on YouTube. Follow that. It'll take you to Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and you can press sub on the or follow on the podcast. We appreciate that. And you won't miss any more in our series. All right. There's a lot more to come. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
There we go. Here I am. I know a lot of you are watching the Welcome to the Family doc on Hulu right now. If you're not, it's pretty good. And getting your first taste of the Adelsons. Isn't that bursting with country fresh flavor? Oh. Oh, yeah. Ooh, have seconds on that, right? What we're doing here, I'm helping you kind of break down the whole damn story in case you're like, I got to learn more about that. Well, welcome. We're going to help you do that. We already have one video in the can, as they say, and it should already be out by the time you're watching this. This is our second in the series. This is the dentist. This is where we're going to jump a little bit more into the dental practice and kind of explain some of the logistics of what the hell was going on with the Adelsons, the allegations, and what's been proven in a court of law as well. In as cohesive, entertaining, sometimes darkly funny, because it's horrific how stupid these people are, way that we can. I know it's a horrible thing, but you know, that sometimes we add that in to get through it. So I welcome your thoughts, like I said, in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Here is where Charlie Adelson's extortion story starts sounding less like terror and more like financing. According to Charlie, the man threatening to kill him were willing to accept monthly payments through his family's dental practice, a layaway plan, if you will. No cash dropped under a bridge. Not one desperate handoff and then silence. A payment plan. Remember Charlie? Charlie said he was bamboozled here, that he had mentioned being frustrated and that it would be a great idea to kill Dan, and never actually ordered it. It was his girlfriend who got some people involved and they did it. And now they want to be paid. And he wasn't planning any of this. So how about a layaway plan? How about you pay us in installments through checks at the dental practice and have mom sign them? That almost sounds like Mad Libs, doesn't it? It sounds like something I was just kind of making up as I was going. No, that's exactly what happened. Charlie did not deny that money moved. He did not deny that Catherine McBonner received cash and later received checks connected to his family's dental practice. He did not deny the calls, the continued relationship, the hitman joke, or the conversation recorded at Dolce Vita. His answer was that everybody... They have the story backward, because according to Charlie, Dan Markell's killing was not something he arranged. It was something Sigfrido Garcia and Luis Rivera carried out on their own after learning about the ugly custody fight through McBonner. Then Charlie said McBonner came to his home and told him the men wanted $1/3 million. So she's friends, you know, and she's got the baby daddy that's in the gangs down in Miami. And they're just like, whoa. That sounds like a problem for us, the superhero gang fighting villains, fighting for custody battles of rich white people villain. Oh, wait, that's not a thing. They don't just like, it's not like a side hustle where it's like, I'm going to order the products from Amway and then I'm going to sell them and then I'm going to get my commission. Like, no. This isn't like a multi-level marketing scheme for murder. They're coming to claim their rewards. But that's how Charlie was trying to pitch it. He had 48 hours to pay, or he and his family could be killed. Charlie testified that he opened his safe and handed over about $138,000. The rest would be paid in monthly installments of roughly $3,000. So yes, the defense presented jurors with what amounted to a payment plan for death. Now, before we turn that into a punchline, let's give Charlie the strongest version of his own argument. People who are terrified do irrational things. They freeze. They hide. They decide the police will make everything worse. They stay close to dangerous people because they believe those people are also protecting them. Fear is not orderly, and it does not have to make sense to somebody sitting safely in a courtroom 9 years later. That part is fair. The problem is that fear had to explain absolutely everything. It had to explain why the people supposedly demanding immediate payment under threat of death were willing to wait month after month. It had to explain why McBonner began receiving checks from the Adelson Institute about 2 months after Dan was shot. Financial investigator Mary Howell testified that there were 44 checks that Donna Adelson signed every one, and that the twice monthly payments continued until May of 2016. Apparently, the threat was urgent, but the alleged extortionists respected the dental office billing cycle. The defense got an important concession out of Hull. A bank record can show where money went, but it cannot tell a jury why. A check does not arrive stamped murder payment or extortion payment. Hull agreed that the financial records alone could not tell jurors which story was true. Fine, but they could show the system. They showed who got paid. They showed when the checks began. They showed who signed them. They showed That was not one terrified handoff in a parking lot. It became a reoccurring business arrangement running through a legitimate family practice. And that is where Charlie's explanation stopped being one frightened man's odd decision and became an entire alternate operating system. Jurors had to believe the safest way to satisfy people threatening to kill a millionaire was to put the woman carrying the threat on something that looked like payroll and let his mother handle the checks. Then the jury heard from Louis Rivera. Rivera was no choir boy arriving with clean hands and a civic duty speech. He pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and received a 19-year sentence. It runs with a federal sentence. He had every reason to cooperate, and the defense had every reason to attack him for it. Rivera testified that Garcia recruited him, that Garcia was the shooter, and that the two men traveled from South Florida to Tallahassee. According to Rivera, they followed Dan after he dropped his children at preschool, went to the gym, and returned home. Dan was then shot in his garage. He died the next day at 41 years old, leaving two young boys without their father. Rivera said the job came through McBona and that the motive involved a woman wanting her children back. He also described payment in $100 bills stapled into $100 bundles. Prosecutors presented evidence that Charlie routinely kept stapled cash the same way. Could Rivera lie? Of course. Cooperating witnesses can lie with astounding confidence when freedom is on the menu. And the prosecution was not asking jurors to admire Rivera. It was asking whether his account fit the rental car, the travel, the surveillance, the relationships, and the money. And then came McBona, the bridge between Charlie and Garcia. Her credibility problems were even larger. Her first trial ended without a unanimous verdict. Her second ended with convictions for first-degree murder, conspiracy, and solicitation. She was serving life. She admitted that she lied during her own proceedings because she was trying to save herself. That's not a footnote. That's the first thing any honest analysis is going to say about her testimony. So she comes in a little damaged, if you will. The defense argued that cooperation was her only imaginable path towards a different future. Prosecutors said she had been promised a sentence reduction, and that is exactly why jurors had to treat every word she gave rather carefully. McBona denied extorting Charlie. She testified that Charlie is the one who proposed the killing, that she recruited Garcia, and that later payments were connected to Dan's death rather than legitimate work. She described the initial cash, as not only stapled, but wet. She also said she believed Charlie's parents, or possibly Donna, the allegation in the dark, bizarre story goes, is that Donna literally washed the money in a washing machine to launder it. These are the criminal masterminds we're dealing with in this case. I know. That last part was her belief. Not proven by a video of Donna at the sink giving $100 bills a delicate cycle. Although, wouldn't that be great? This is where people tend to outrun the evidence. The wet cash was testimony. The claim about who watched it was McBona's interpretation. So it should stay that way, technically, but come on. The wet cash was still one more place where the two stories collided. Charlie said he surrendered money because he was afraid. McBona said she received money because the killing had been completed. Jurors did not need to decide that McBona had suddenly become trustworthy in every area of life. They had to decide which account required fewer miracles. And then there was Charlie's own voice. In April of 2016, the FBI staged what became known as The Bump. An undercover agent approached Donna with material suggesting that someone connected to Rivera wanted money, Donna contacted Charlie. Charlie later met McBona at the Dolce Vita restaurant while investigators recorded the conversation. Parts of that recording were difficult to hear. The state used enhanced audio prepared by former CIA audio forensic specialist James Keith McLevin, but Judge Stephen Everett warned jurors that the transcript was not evidence. They had to rely on what they actually heard. That's important because the recording was not a movie confession. Charlie did not sit down, order an appetizer, and announce the entire conspiracy for a microphone. Prosecutors argued that the guarded language sounded like people protecting a shared secret. The defense argued that it sounded like a man trying to understand a new extortion threat. And came the line about the airport. Charlie was recorded saying that if authorities had evidence, we would have already gone to the airport. He testified that he meant there was no evidence because he was innocent. Prosecutors heard something else, not a declaration that he would never run, but a statement that the presence of evidence, if in the right hands, might change travel plans. Could that sentence be interpreted more than one way? Sure. But jurors did not hear it floating alone in space. They heard it beside the checks, the cash, the prosecution's fake employment theory, the calls, and Charlie's refusal to contact law enforcement while claiming armed men were threatening his family. They also heard the hitman joke. Charlie admitted joking that the television he bought Wendy as a divorce gift was cheaper than hiring a hitman. He called it one of the stupidest things he had ever said and insisted it was only a joke. And one disgusting joke does not prove an agreement to kill anybody. But once Dan was killed by men connected through Charlie's former girlfriend, that joke stopped being harmless background noise. It became another fact. Charlie needed the jury to seal inside its own little container and never place next to anything else. That was the entire defense problem. Okay, let's accept the initial cash as fear, now accept the checks as fear, accept McBona's continued access to Charlie as fear, accept the business records as a delivery system, accept the guarded calls as confession, accept the airport line as confidence, accept the hitman joke as meaningless, accept that Charlie believed McBona was innocent for years, even though his secret account supposedly could have explained the case. Any one of those things might be possible, but all of them had to be true at once. Charlie was arrested on April 21st of 2022 after a Leon County grand jury charged him with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation to commit murder. He chose to testify at his 2023 trial, which means jurors did not have to imagine how he would explain the contradictions. They watched him do it. On November 6th of 23, after roughly 3 hours of deliberation, a jury found him guilty on all three counts. On December 12th, Judge Everett sentenced him to life without parole plus two consecutive 30-year terms. Charlie maintained his innocence. His direct appeal later focused heavily on whether years of publicity made it impossible to receive a fair trial in Leon County. It wasn't a ridiculous concern. Of 130 prospective jurors questioned, 96 had heard about the case. 54 said they had formed an opinion, and 53 of those believed Charlie was guilty. But all 54 were removed. Then the appeal ran into a problem no amount of courtroom drama could really fix: procedure. The First District Court of Appeal ruled on July 1st of 26 that the venue issue had not been properly preserved because defense counsel did not file the required written motion with supporting materials and did not renew the objection before the jury was sworn. The court also looked beyond that mistake and found no record showing that the jurors who actually served were biased. The convictions and sentences were affirmed. So yes, the paperwork hurt the appeal, but the court did not simply hide behind a technicality. It also reviewed the jury selection record and found no fundamental unfairness in the people who actually served. Charlie Adelson's extortion defense did not fail because frightened people always act logically. They do not. It failed because every piece of evidence needed its own private exception to common sense, and every exception somehow transformed a prosecution fact into proof that Charlie was the real victim. Smart people sometimes believe that complexity is the same thing as credibility, and enough detail, create enough alternate explanations. Maybe somebody will notice that the entire machine is running backwards. But juries are not required to admire the engineering. One strange decision can be misunderstood. Two can be coincidence, but the whole story requires us to rename the money, reinterpret the relationships, ignore the business structure, and believe that men threatening immediate death accepted a multi-year installment agreement through a dental office. That's not just an explanation anymore. It's a bizarre sales pitch with a payment plan for murder. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. There's more to come in our series. Donna's next. Oh, Donna. We're going to dive deep into her world. And after that, Wendy. Where is she today? Press subscribe so you don't miss any of it. Take our podcast with you wherever you go so you can listen at work, in the car, at the gym, wherever. The QR code is there on the screen on YouTube. If you're watching us right now, just scan it and press subscribe. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get them. We'd love for you to be a regular listener. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
A one-way plane ticket is not necessarily a confession. People buy one-way tickets for innocent reasons. We're talking about the Adelsons. I don't know how innocent the reasons are. The ticket alone does not prove that Donna was fleeing. And that's true. If it's by itself, just a ticket. A ticket doesn't mean much. What made the Vietnam trip look so bad was everything Donna Adelson said before she reached the jet bridge. We're talking about the Adelsons. This is part three in our series as we're going through the family story, the history. If you've just seen the Hulu documentary, this is one you may be sitting here going, you know what? I think I'd like a better understanding of all this. So part one and part two are already out in our feed. Check that out. Pick it up here with part three. One day after Charlie Adelson was found guilty, Donna was speaking on a jail call that she apparently believed had ended. The line was still open. She forgot to hang up the phone. Jurors later heard her discuss S, you know, ending it, taking the self-exit ramp of life, leaving the United States, non-extradition countries, wills, papers, and getting affairs in orders. Prosecutors argued that this was not a grieving mother trying to clear her head. It was a woman who believed the legal machinery was turning straight towards her. Then Donna and her husband, Harvey, booked a one-way itinerary to Vietnam. On November 13th, 2023, FBI agents reached them on the jet bridge at Miami International Airport before they boarded the first leg of the trip. Harvey was not arrested and had not been charged. Donna was arrested that night and indicted 2 days later on first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation of murder. Her defense had an answer for the trip. They had an answer for everything, really. The family friend testified that he recommended a one-way ticket because the return date was uncertain and they planned to return for their grandson's bar mitzvah. You know, they'll be back. Donna's attorneys argued that she was shattered by Charlie's conviction and wanted to clear her mind, maybe. When your destination is a country without a U.S. extradition treaty and you have been recorded discussing S, non-extradition countries, wills and papers, clearing your mind stops sounding like an explanation and starts sounding kind of like brochure copy. That became the pattern at trial, each damning fact derived with an innocent label and a very long footnote. The prosecution's theory was that Donna was not simply a loud mother-in-law who inserted herself into a bitter divorce. It portrayed her as the family manager, the person who ran the office, pushed the relocation campaign, kept Charlie informed, signed the checks, and treated Dan Markell as a problem that had to be removed from the family's path. The defense said the state had taken a controlling personality and converted it into a murder case. Being controlling is not a felony. And ugly emails are not a murder agreement. But Donna's behavior mattered because prosecutors said it revealed how she responded when somebody told her no. After a judge refused to let Wendy move the children from Tallahassee to South Florida, Donna did not treat that decision as the end of the matter. Emails shown at trial included increasingly aggressive ideas for pressuring Dan. There were discussions of offering him as much as $1 million to agree to move. There were proposals involving the children's religious upbringing. And there was Donna suggesting that the boys be dressed in Nazi uniforms to provoke their Jewish father. Yes, that's part of the story. Donna was so angry, she threatened to raise the grandchildren Catholic and dress them in Nazi uniforms and send them to their father as a FU, love from grandma, sort of thing. You know, what sane people do. Wendy testified that some of those ideas were crazy, and that she did not carry them out. She was right about the first part. Dressing children as Nazis to antagonize their father is not a normal grandmother strategy for some reason. It is what happens when resentment puts on a cardigan and calls itself family problem solving. Still, ugliness is not necessarily proof of murder. The prosecution's point was narrower and more damaging. Donna did not seem to experience boundaries as boundaries. She's experienced them as challenges. The court denied relocation, so another pressure campaign followed. Dan resisted the money, the pressure, and the threats to change his children's religious life. He also had a pending motion seeking to limit Donna's unsupervised access to the boys. The state argued that the conflict kept narrowing until Dan himself became the only obstacle left. Then came the money. After Dan was shot in July of 2014, Catherine McBonnie began receiving checks from the Adelson Institute. Financial investigator Mary Hull testified that 44 checks were issued, that Donna signed every one, and that the twice monthly payments continued until May of 2016. Prosecutors said McBonnie did not perform legitimate work for the practice and that the checks were ongoing compensation tied to the killing. Donna's defense did not deny the signatures. It said she signed the checks because she managed the office under Charlie's extortion story. The family was paying because McBonnie and men connected to her had threatened Charlie. Donna, the defense argued, was helping the frightened son, not paying for a completed crime. She's just helping her son write checks to the woman that he once dated. Why did he date that woman anyhow? I would never have approved of that. But here's another check, Charlie. Come back for lunch so we can have milk and cookies.
And then you're kind of concerned that Donna might still be breastfeeding Charlie at the age of 42.
Charlie, there is a time where this has to stop. Okay, signing checks at a business you run is not automatically sinister, but the jury was not looking at 44 random vendor payments. It was looking at reoccurring checks to the woman, prosecutors said, connected Charlie to Garcia and Rivera. It was looking at payments that began after Dan was killed. It was looking at a defense theory in which alleged extortionists threatening immediate death were apparently comfortable with two checks a month from mom. Then the FBI staged the bump in 2016. An undercover agent approached Donna and handed her materials suggesting that someone connected to Luis Rivera wanted money. The operation was designed to provoke a reaction. Donna reacted by contacting Charlie. Wiretaps captured a series of guarded calls and meetings. Prosecutors argued that mother and son were speaking in code because they shared knowledge of the killing. The defense said the calls reflected fear of extortion. Again, either interpretation is possible if you isolate the words. That was the defense's constant advantage and constant problem. Isolate the check and it's an ordinary bookkeeping. Isolate the call, it's a frightened family. Isolate the trip and it's a vacation. Isolate an email and it's rage. The state's case came from refusing to keep all those facts in separate rooms. The television fit the same pattern. On the morning Dan, we shot Wendy, had a geek squad appointment for a damaged television. Wendy testified that Donna scheduled it. How interesting. Donna is scheduling TV repair appointments for her 30-some-year-old daughter who's living on her own, has children. Mom's still scheduling your TV repair fix appointment. What? Charlie had previously joked that buying Wendy a television as a divorce gift was cheaper than hiring a hitman. Prosecutors argued that television references became coded language and that the repair appointment helped place Wendy at home when the shooting occurred. Donna's lawyer said a mother scheduling a service call is not proof of building an alibi. Donna's first trial, set for September 17th of 2024, collapsed before jury selection because her lead attorney, Daniel Rashbaum, had also represented Charlie, and Charlie would not waive a conflict involving privileged communication. So Rashbaum withdrew, and Judge Everett postponed the case. Donna eventually hired Jackie Fulford and Josh Zellman. Her new trial began in August of 25. And by the way, as we always say, Jackie Fulford from a mortuary. She operates out of a crematorium, I should say. She operates out of a crematorium. I'm not even joking. You look her up, you look up her office, it's a crematorium. Yeah, I mean, it's a family. It's nothing wrong with that. I mean, family businesses are family businesses, but it is a little, like, I don't know, bizarre, odd, funny, dark. That the, in my opinion, shitty attorney for Donna Adelson also operates out of a crematorium. This is the best you could get. The state called Wendy and Donna's estranged son, Robert, to the stand. Wendy denied knowing about or participating in the killing and testified about his mother, her mother's anger during the relocation fight. Robert described Donna as deeply involved in her children's lives and said he knew, or said he saw little curiosity inside the family about who actually killed Dan, which is a rather interesting fact, considering they're accused of being the ones who did it. If you didn't do it, I mean, it is the father of the grandchildren, people in your family. It is, you know, he does play a role in your lives. I'd be a little curious. Who, why? I mean, is there somebody going after the whole family as a whole, or is it just limited to Dan? I don't know. That did not establish a plot, but it deepened the prosecution's portrait of a mother's intensity and her intense involvement in Wendy's life as an adult. Then two jailhouse witnesses offered something that ended up being even a little more direct. Patricia Byrd testified that Donna admitted involvement and said it was about keeping her grandchildren. Although Byrd quoted her as saying it was not supposed to go that far, that was Byrd's account. It was not recorded, and defense attacked her credibility, inconsistencies, and legal problems. Good. Jailhouse testimony should arrive with a warning large enough to cover the witness stand. But Byrd also testified that Donna wanted her to give false testimony about McBonough and offered benefits. It allegedly included a trailer, land, and dental work from Harvey. Free dental work. Byrd said McBonough never made the statements Donna wanted attributed to her. Then came Drina Bernhardt, whom Donna called Sunshine, and described as a jail daughter. Burnthout testified that Donna wanted her to present a false story in which McBonough had extorted Charlie. Prosecutors introduced a handwritten question and answer script and expert testimony attributing the writing to Donna. Burnthout said Donna told her to copy it in her own handwriting and promised benefits that included commissary items, phone time, $10,000, and a grand piano. A grand piano. As apparently the alleged false testimony package came in concert hall trim. The defense argued that Burnhart manipulated Donna into writing the material and emphasized Bernhardt's own reason to help prosecutors. There was no audio recording explaining why the script was created. The state's handwriting evidence tied Donna to the words. Burnhart just supplied the alleged purpose. Donna herself chose not to testify in her trial, and jurors were instructed not to hold that constitutional choice against her. Her lawyers presented witnesses supporting the innocent explanation for the Vietnam trip. In closing, the defense gave the jury its cleanest line. Donna was a meddler. She's just a meddler. She's not a murderer. That line had force because the state had no recorded meeting in which Donna ordered Dan killed. The jury had to decide whether the surrounding conduct provided criminal agreement. Prosecutors told them to look at the whole machine. Relocation campaign, the escalating hostility, the checks, the bump calls, testimony from convicted participants, the alleged jail confession, the handwritten script, and the departure attempt after Charlie's conviction. On September 4th of 25, after a little more than 3 hours of deliberation, a jury found Donna guilty on all three counts. At sentencing on October 13th, Donna maintained her innocence. She said what happened to Dan was unforgivable, but insisted she had been convicted without evidence. Then, in a courtroom dealing with a first-degree murder conviction, she told the judge that she never received a parking ticket. How could I have done this? I've never received a parking ticket. You fools! That may be the most Donna Adelson. The most sense, I guess, Donna Adelson has ever spoken. Not because a clean driving record proves anything. Because it reduces accountability to paperwork. Look at my history. Look at my status. Look at the respectable life I built. Surely a person like me cannot be the person the verdict says I am. Judge Everett told Donna she could maintain her innocence, but said the evidence was clear and criticized what he called her utter lack of remorse. He sentenced her to life without parole, followed by a consecutive 30-year term. Donna filed a direct appeal, and that appeal remained pending as of September 3rd of 26. A conviction does not make every prosecution argument correct forever. Donna can challenge the evidence, rulings, and fairness at the trial, though. She can do all that on appeal. But the verdict means the jury rejected the defense's central picture of an intrusive grandmother who repeatedly wandered into incriminating circumstances created by everybody else. The jurors did not accept that she signed the checks without criminal knowledge, spoke guardedly without sharing a secret, wrote the jailhouse script for an innocent purpose, and booked the Vietnam flight without trying to get beyond the reach of what was coming. Any one of those explanations could have survived alone. Donna needed all of them. And that's a larger point here. Control can disguise itself as love for years. It calls itself concern. It calls itself protection. It says it's only trying to help the children. But when love requires everyone else to comply, every boundary becomes an insult and every refusal becomes a problem to solve. At that point, love is no longer the point. Winning is. Dan Markell was 41 when he was killed. His sons are growing up without him. Five people are now serving sentences for roles in the plot. Wendy and Harvey Adelson have not been charged. Wendy has repeatedly denied involvement. Woman prosecutors described as the person who managed everything finally reached the one thing she could not manage. 12 jurors looking at the entire pattern and refusing to call it a coincidence. So what about Wendy? What is her involvement? Is she going to be prosecuted? Or does she have nothing to do with any of this other than having a really shitty family?
That's coming up next. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss it. Until then, your thoughts in the comments section. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
So if you watch the Hulu documentary about the Adelsons and you're here now going, I want to learn more. Well, welcome to the fourth part in our series as we break down all of the Adelsons and their lovely ways. If you're just joining us, like I said, this is part four. We've already covered Donna. We've covered Harvey. We've covered Charlie. And the dynamics of the other folks in this, including Catherine McBanua and the hitman Sigfrido Garcia, all of that. We've hit it all. Now we're up to the actual woman who benefited most from the decisions that her family made poorly. And the big question has been for so many years, what did she know? The answer might be nothing. What did Wendy know about her family plotting to end the life of her ex-husband, the father of her children, the father of the grandchildren, the father of the niece and the nephew of these people that have been convicted of taking his life so they could have more access to the kids? That worked out well, didn't it? Wendy certainly got more access in this whole process. Didn't quite work out as good for everybody else, though. So, is this a story where the family way oversteps their bounds because they have no boundaries and did what they wanted to do despite Wendy saying,
maybe it's not a good idea to kill my husband. I don't know. I don't think it's a nice idea. I don't think you should do that. It's icky.
I don't know. I have no idea. But I mean, judging by Wendy's demeanor in court, I'm thinking that maybe how it could have gone. Hey, we're thinking of killing your husband, your ex-husband.
Come on.
Rather than no. What on earth are you thinking? That's insane.
Oh, God.
Guys, I know you love me so much. Again, I have no idea what happened, but judging by the enmeshed family of the Adelsons, that's probably not a far cry from reality, in my opinion. But again, Wendy's never been charged with anything. She's maintaining her innocence. There is one sentence of the Dan Markell case that has now been repeated in courtroom after courtroom, and nobody can play the recording because the recording does not exist. Jeffrey Lacasse says Wendy Adelson said it to him 5 days before Dan was shot. According to Lacasse, Wendy asked whether she could tell him something confidential. Then she told him that her brother, Charlie, looked into every option for dealing with the Danny Markell problem, including hiring a hitman that would cost about $15,000. Now, why you tell your boyfriend this in confidence is beyond me. Is that make the love bond that much stronger when you're going at it? It's like, oh, she told me about how, or I told him how we might hire a hitman. Oh, we're so much closer. I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the link, but I do think it's the sharing of information in very much the same way that a 7-year-old little girl would share a secret. Can't hold it in. It's just too much. And I better, because Wendy, in a lot of ways, as educated as she is, as intelligent as she is, emotionally, I think some may argue, maybe a little stunted. Not that it's, not saying a fault of her own. Again, this is all conjecture. I don't know if she's stunted or not, but judging by the reactions in this case and what we've seen publicly, one may come to that conclusion. I'm going, yeah, wow.
Your mom's hiring the TV repairman. Your parents do so much damn shit for you. You're a grown-ass adult with your own children, and you're still being treated like you're about 10. That may stunt someone. That may make someone be able to function over here as an adult. And over here, still as if, you know, Disney afternoon's coming on. It's time to have a granola bar and watch Tailspin. Or DuckTales, or Darkwing Duck, or Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. I know my fucking Disney afternoon from 1993, goddammit. According to Lacoste, Wendy asked whether she could tell him something confidential. Confidential.
Danny Martell, $15,000.
Lacoste, he called that conversation chilling. He said it made his stomach flip. Wouldn't it, you? With this girl? Family's a little nutty? A little bit extreme?
They're talking about her and a hitman.
Yeah. Wendy has denied saying it. She's denied knowing that Dan was going to be killed. She's denied helping anyone carry it out. And as of now, she's never been charged with a crime connected to Dan's death. So let's be very clear about where this story begins. Not with a proven confession, not with a recording, and not with a charge. It begins with two people describing the same private conversation in ways that cannot both be accurate. That's what makes Wendy Adelson different from everybody else in this case. Siegfriedo Garcia, Catherine McBonnet, Charlie Adelson, and Donna Adelson were all convicted. Luis Rivera pled guilty and testified for the state. Each has either been convicted by a jury or admitted guilt in court. Wendy has not. Prosecutors have called her a conspirator in court, but they have not put that allegation into the indictment. Wendy has repeatedly said they are wrong. And that line matters. A courtroom cannot transfer guilt through a family tree, no matter how many relatives have been convicted. But those of us on the outside, we can read the tea leaves. But being uncharged does not make the surrounding facts disappear. It means we have to discuss them without pretending the unanswered question has already been answered. LaCay stated Wendy during 2013 and 2014 when her divorce and custody fight with Dan dominated much of her life. He testified that the case was a constant topic of conversation and described the Adelsons as a family without boundaries. He also spent time around Charlie. During a South Florida visit, LaCay had dinner with Charlie and Catherine McBanua. Later, according to LaCay, Charlie bragged that he knew people on both sides of the tracks. I'm the dentist everybody wants to know because I know the folks on this side of the track and the folks on that side of the track. I do fillings for each. Tight. Doctors and dentists. One side, people connected to the criminal world. On the other, Charlie. Charlie after dark, if you will. That's where Charlie... We don't want to see that side of Charlie when he goes to that side of the tracks. Because Charlie becomes the wild and crazy dentist at that point. Woo! That comment did not prove Charlie was arranging anything. People brag, people exaggerate. Some men can turn one dinner into a one-person podcast about how connected and dangerous they are. But 4 months later, Dan was shot by a man linked to Charlie through McBanua. Suddenly, the bragging did not sound quite as decorative. Then came the conversation LaCoste says happened 5 days before the shooting. LaCoste did not say when he told him Charlie had begun shopping for a hitman that week. He recalled her saying Charlie had explored those options the previous summer. You're shopping for a new sweater at Dillard's. I'm exploring my options over here. What's at the fragrance counter? What's new over here? I'm exploring the options. Hitman, $15,000. Is that a deal? Or is that a ripoff, considering how things didn't work out all that well?
I mean, if you're going to knock somebody, I don't know what it costs to hire a hitman, but I mean, judging from the stories that we hear on this program, the going rate seems to be around $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a hit from the hitmen that end up being talked about on this show. They end up being talked about on the show because things don't go so well. So I'm thinking if you're in the market for a hitman, you better go above the bargain basement 10, 15 G ones because they don't seem to go down all that smoothly. I'm thinking maybe you want to go to the bigger tier. Maybe not the Walmart level hitmen. Maybe go to the Target level. Maybe just take it up a step. Go to the ones maybe 30, 40,000. Maybe they cross their T's and dot their I's a little smoother. I don't know. But if you're trying to make an educated guess based on the stories we talk about that have hitmen in them, if you're paying around 10 to 15 or anything below, your odds of ending up on this program dramatically increase. Just saying. Charlie had explored those options the previous summer. Still, she allegedly brought it up days before Dan was attacked in the middle of collapsing the relationship while discussing a custody conflict. Again, Wendy says the conversation never happened. Jeff Lacoste says they're talking about custody. They're talking about the family, their relationship falling apart. It's rough. And by the way, my brother might be hiring a hitman. He explored the options. There's no clean way around that conflict. If Lacoste remembered it accurately, Wendy knew her brother had at least discussed hiring someone to kill Dan long before police ever questioned her. If Wendy is telling the truth, then Lacoste attached an extraordinarily damaging statement to the conversation that never contained it. That's not a disagreement over tone. That is the Grand Canyon with two people standing on opposite sides pointing at each other. The timing became even more uncomfortable when Lacoste described what happened next. He testified that Wendy asked detailed questions about his drive to Tallahassee on Friday, July 18th, including when he planned to leave and which route he would take. Lacoste says that route could have taken him past Dan's neighborhood around the same time of the shooting. Interesting to want to know when you're going to be passing by the scene of a crime that you know nothing about, days before it occurs. That might be, I don't know. I don't know anything about this, but my boyfriend was over. Oh my gosh, is my boyfriend doing this to pretend? That might have been the plan. Just never quite worked out that way. Never quite got far enough down the road of madness to, attempt to cast that dispersion over to Mr. Lacoste. Lacoste drove a gray Nissan Sentra at Donna's trial. He compared it to gray Nissan Altima Garcia and Rivera had rented during an earlier Tallahassee trip. But the car used on July 18th was a rented green Toyota Prius, so this was not a clean same car match. Lacoste eventually told investigators he believed Wendy may have been trying to make him look like an alternative suspect. That was his interpretation. No public evidence, other than what we've talked about, establishes that Wendy planted physical evidence directed police towards him or manufactured a record tying him to the shooting. And that's important, but as everything in this case goes, objects in the rearview mirror may be closer than they appear. That's not that close. It actually is. But the questions bothered him because of the alleged hitman conversation and because the relationship was breaking apart at exactly the same time. Could a girlfriend ask him about a boyfriend's travel route? For completely innocent reasons, of course. Could the same questions look different after her former husband is killed on the date being discussed? Obviously. That's the problem throughout Wendy's story. Almost every suspicious detail comes with a possible innocent explanation. The explanations are not impossible. They just keep arriving exactly when needed. Take the television. Charlie had bought Wendy a television as a divorce gift, like one does. He admitted making the grotesque joke that the television was cheaper than hiring a hitman. Randy called it a tasteless joke. Charlie later called it one of the stupidest things he's ever said. And look, on the surface, people make tasteless jokes. People make inappropriate jokes all the time. I happen to be one of them. So when I heard that, I'm like, eh. I mean, people say stupid shit, especially when you're going through a very dramatic phase of life. One may go to extremes in their joking to make light. Again, I do it all the time. It's not that I'm ever doing anything. I know that. But it looks incredibly suspicious when you actually were seriously looking into such things and then joking about them. That takes it a little far beyond, let's say something extreme and get a reaction to, let's say something extreme. I was actually studying this, looking it up and considering my options, and now I'm just going to kind of throw it in here. As I buy you a TV that seemingly is going to need to be repaired from a repair that, if we understand correctly, is an irreparable device. Because if you remember correctly, and I'm trying to remember correctly as I'm talking about this, so take it for what it's worth with conjecture. The television, from what we understand, something had hit it. Something had, and as we all know, modern televisions that have a big hit in it, crack in it, somebody pushes on the screen too hard, it breaks the screen. You're screwed. There's no fixing that device. It's broken. You have to go buy a new one. TVs are cheap these days, so people just replace them and you don't repair it. A common sense observation of the television, based on some of the testimony from Wendy's ex-boyfriend, would have told you, don't call a repairman. There's nothing you can fix on this damn thing. It is broken. So the premise of calling the repairman, which Donna did, not Wendy, which I find a little odd, that by itself, I apologize, it's allergy season. And somebody said, I'm going to buy you Zyrtec. I already take Allegra and Mucinex. Might as well add it to the link, or add it to the list, if you will, of things I'm taking. Even the TV seems a little bit too perfectly set up. Like, why are you getting this TV as a divorce present? Why is it suddenly broken? Why is it an obvious thing that if it's it's a problem with it the way it is broken, that it's clearly not fixable by a repairman showing up? Maybe Wendy's just that stupid. Maybe Donna's that stupid. I mean, Donna did allegedly launder money in a washing machine. So I don't know. Maybe the assumption I'm making of the TV is broken and clearly broken and not fixable is too much of an assumption that the nitwits in the Adelson family would understand that this is not a fixable television. I don't know. Maybe I am thinking too much into that one. Could be. Either way, it is a red flag. On the morning Dan was shot, Wendy was at home waiting for the Geek Squad technician to repair the television that Donna scheduled. Donna called it in. For her 30-some-year-old adult daughter with children, grandma's calling Best Buy's Geek Squad for a television that's not even in her house. Again, weird. Weird. Could it be Donna and Charlie going, keep Wendy over here? She's got the appointment.
Charlie, this is Donna. We're going to get Geek Squad involved. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It sounds good, Ma.
We're going to get Geek Squad involved. I have my friends over at the Best Buy and they are going to come and they're going to fix her TV, and Wendy's not going to know any better. She's going to sit at home. And she's going to watch the TV be fixed while we take care of them.
Something like that. I don't know. And Winnie might have been like, okay, Mom, whatever you say. Can you bring me a fruit roll-up? A broken television is not an alibi conspiracy. Mothers schedule service calls for adult children every day, unfortunately, because they don't allow their children to grow up and to be grown-ass adults, especially mothers who treat adulthood as a customer service problem. Prosecutors argue that references to the television became coded language inside the family and that the repair appointment helped establish where Wendy would be that morning. Wendy decided that TV meant murder or that the appointment was anything other than an ordinary repair. Wendy denied that any of that was what it meant. That's the allegations. It's all code word. Wendy's like, nope, I don't think so. Then there's Trescott Drive. After the shooting, but before police told her what had happened, Wendy drove towards the street where Dan lived. She testified that she was headed to a liquor store to buy bourbon for lunch and try to use Trescott as part of the route. Gotta get my bourbon. When that's your mom, Wendy, I don't fucking blame you. The road was blocked with crime scene tape, so she turned around. She said she did not know the police activity involved Dan. Again, weird moment in this case where there's police tape around your ex-husband's house where your children also happen to be. And you're like, yeah, liquor store. Floor it. People sometimes talk about that drive as though the road itself convicts her. It doesn't. An innocent person could take that route. Person checking whether something had happened could take that route too. The car cannot tell us which thought was inside the driver's head. What makes that drive relevant is the timing, the destination, and the alleged conversation with Lacoste. Relevant does not mean conclusive. It means the drive belongs to the same timeline as everything else. And then Wendy did something that does not fit the cartoon version of a guilty mastermind, quietly hiding behind lawyers. She went with police and sat through a long recorded interview without an attorney. She talked a lot. She acknowledged that police would naturally look at the ex-wife. She mentioned her parents' hostility towards Dan. She brought up Charlie's hitman joke. I mean, Wendy did everything a passive-aggressive bitch would do who doesn't want any blame coming on her. Oh, my gosh. Do you think it could be Charlie? He joked about a hitman. Oh! Like mother, like daughter. Let me sprinkle little things over here so your attention goes away from me. Although, who knows? Maybe she was just, you know, that stupid. That unaware of what's going on. Maybe she knew how insulated she was, that she could go to the cops and she could play innocent and she could play foolish and stupid and have no idea what's going on because her family had insulated her so much that there was nothing that anyone was going to find on Wendy because Wendy truly had nothing to do with this. She was just close enough to know there's a raging inferno in the next room. Everybody's going, there's smoke over there. Nah. It'll burn itself out. And she's right, it did. But again, all conjecture. She agreed to fingerprinting, a gunshot residue test, and searches of her phone and computer, according to her testimony. That cooperation matters. It supports the argument that Wendy behaved like a shocked former spouse, not somebody trying to shut down questioning. Prosecutors see the interview differently. They have suggested that Wendy placed the hitman joke and her family's anger into the conversation in a rather controlled way, giving police a version that sounded canon while keeping any alleged advanced knowledge out of it. The consequences to those involved in it be damned. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe she was simply in shock and saying everything that crossed her mind. The recording gives us her words. It does not give us a reliable scan on her intent. After Dan's death, Wendy moved the boys to South Florida. She later changed her surnames from Markell to Adelson right after he was killed. You know, like you do. Hey, Dad's dead. How should we remember him? We're going to hold his name close to our heart for the rest of our lives. Nope, we're going to change it because Grandma wants it different.
We're going to wipe him away. Those decisions remain deeply painful to Dan's parents and have become part of the public suspicion surrounding her. But receiving the outcome your family wanted does not prove you joined the plan that produced it. That point cannot be skipped. Motive can explain conduct. Benefit can explain motive. Neither one by itself establishes agreement. Still, the outcome is impossible to ignore. The court had refused to let Wendy relocate the children. Dan's death removed the legal obstacle. She moved south. The children grew up there. The life Donna had fought for became a reality temporarily. Then there was the dinner. A few weeks after Dan was killed, Wendy and Charlie had dinner together. Wendy and Lacoste agree the dinner happened. The testimony established that Wendy became sick during it. They disagree about what that dinner actually meant. Lacoste testified that Wendy told him Charlie called it a celebratory dinner. Wendy denied that description and said she was unhappy and grieving. The defense attacked Lacoste's interpretation and account. Once again, no recording, two accounts, one detail that lands very differently depending on who you're actually believing. People split into camps here. One side says the pattern makes the absence of charges absurd. The other says each fact has an innocent explanation magnified by years of headlines and family association. The honest answer is less satisfying than either side wants. The public record gives prosecutors questions. It does not tell us whether they believe they have a chargeable case. The delay could reflect evidence problems, immunity, witness limitations, strategy, or facts the public has never seen. There is no charging document to answer it. Wendy testified under subpoena. With use and derivative use immunity, in plain English, prosecutors generally cannot use her compelled testimony or evidence found because of it to build a case against her. Independently obtained evidence remains available. Immaterially false testimony can support perjury. The internet version says one lie detonates the arrangement. It doesn't. Prosecutors would still have to trace through evidence to an independent source and prove every element. That is why Lacoste's account matters and still may not be enough. It establishes what he says he heard. Without a recording or direct corroboration, a jury would have to decide which person accurately remembers private conversations from 2014. That leaves Wendy at the center of the motive, surrounded by convicted relatives, repeatedly questioned under oath, publicly called a conspirator by prosecutors, and still uncharged. It's not public clearance, and it is nowhere near a conviction. A mound of suspicion does not become a charging document because the internet stacks it high enough. We do not have to choose between pretending a pattern means nothing and calling it a verdict. The pattern explains the questions. The burden of proof explains why no courtroom has answered them. None of these facts exist alone. Not the alleged hitman conversation, Lacoste's route, the television Trescott drive, the police interview, and the move south. The name change or the disputed dinner. Everyone has an explanation. The problem is that every explanation arrives on schedule. That does not make Wendy Adelson guilty. It explains why, 12 years after Dan Markell was shot, the biggest unanswered question in this case is still the one no jury has been asked to decide. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. Love for you to weigh in. And, not done so yet, subscribe to the podcast. The link is right there. The QR code is on the screen if you're watching us on YouTube. If you're not there, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi wherever you get podcasts and press subscribe. We do appreciate that. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? they're also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.